Well, good evening. I certainly appreciate everyone being here tonight as we're looking at the book of Daniel. It's my intent to complete the book of Daniel tonight. Well, not complete the book of Daniel. This be my last lesson in the book of Daniel. There's lots in the book of Daniel that's available for further study. And we're going to be covering the 11th and 12th chapters tonight. And if you've read through the 11th chapter, if you're like me, your head is spinning, right? Every time I read through the 11th chapter, I have to stop and say, no, this king was where and who and where. And it's difficult for me to keep up with all. We're not going to go through all that in detail in class. On the 11th chapter, it's one of those chapters that liberal theologians, people that do not believe in the inspiration of the scriptures, want to say that the 10th through the end of the book of Daniel was written sometime shortly before Christ came, after all those historical events actually occurred. What is phenomenal about the last half, particularly the last half of the book of Daniel, and especially about the 11th chapter, is Daniel is writing a little over 500 years before Christ comes. He's going to start with events that are contemporary to him. He's going to end up with events that are 500 years in the future when Christ comes. And you can go by, you can find a good history book, and you can find that the events in the history book, you can identify events there that parallel what Daniel's talking about. And he talks about the Persian rulers. He talks about the Greek rulers. He talks about the Roman rulers. And finally, he talks about the Jews and their rebellions and their problems. All of that's contained in the 11th chapter of the book of Daniel. Right up until, I hope to spend some time tonight. It's really good that Dempsey has been in the 24th chapter of Matthew, because I believe the last part of the book of Daniel is a perfect parallel with the 24th chapter of Matthew, that Daniel is foreseeing the things that Jesus is going to tell us about. And that's why Jesus goes back and quotes from Daniel and calls Daniel to our attention in the 24th chapter of Matthew. And so with that kind of is my goal tonight, I do want to just mention we looked at the ninth chapter. The ninth chapter was Daniel's prayer, and it occurred at the time that the regime change, or that the Persians came to power. And he recognized that Isaiah had prophesied it was going to be 70. They've been captivity 70 years. And so Daniel prays for that. And he gets this extremely, to me, disappointing answer when he gets to the end of it. He's thinking 70 years, and he gets this 70 times 7. It's going to be a long time, Daniel, before the restoration. And so he begins to point Daniel past coming back to Jerusalem and seeing the immediate glory of the temple when they come back to Jerusalem, but to something that's in the future, which is, we know looking back, he's pointing to the day that Jesus comes to the temple and the glory of God is in the temple then, and all that results from Jesus coming to earth and coming to the temple. That's really the true glory that God is going to bring to the temple and his true temple. And so he points Daniel that 70 times 7, which is way to the future. And Daniel's somewhat disappointed with that. Well, about 2 years later, we come to the 10th chapter in Daniel's life. And the children of Israel have started back to Jerusalem. But if you remember reading Haggai and some of those prophets, it wasn't anything at all like when they came out of Egypt. Whenever they came out of Egypt, they had this massive, miraculous victory over the Egyptian army, and they went out in the desert, and God sustained them, and it was a glorious beginning. He gave them law, spoke to them from the mountain. They go back to Jerusalem, and it's a very humble beginning, and remember, the Jerusalem walls are still broken down. Well, Daniel knows about the state of Jerusalem. And I think that probably contributes to what read in the 10th chapter. He had been fasting and mourning for 3 entire weeks. The time frame when he'd been fasting and mourning was in the first month. Well, in the first month is when the Passover occurs. And so he would have been reminded of them coming out of Egypt and the glory of that and knowing what is going on. And so Daniel had been mourning and fasting, says, God, things are not going well. And I think that's the context of the, then now God brings him this revelation to let him know the things that are going to happen. Chapter 10 is basically, as we looked at last week, this majestic one comes to talk with Daniel and tell him there are forces that are in contention that are beyond his comprehension, and that God's forces are going to accomplish God's purpose, is basically what he is told. In chapter 10, he said at the end of in verse 21 of chapter 10, I will tell you what is inscribed in the writing of truth, yet there is no one who stands firmly with me against these forces except Michael, your prince. In the first year of Darius the Mede, I rose to be an encouragement and protection for him. This majestic one is telling Daniel that God has ones that are going to accomplish his purpose. Now, I like that idea that what I will tell you is inscribed in the writing of truth. This majestic one is going to tell Daniel something that's going to be related to the future, but it is already inscribed. That means that God knows it's going to happen and God's going to make it happen. And so the detail we see in chapter 11, which to Daniel was future events, to us is history, but to Daniel, it was the same as history because it was inscribed in truth. And I just wanted to mention those things as we begin our look at the book of Daniel. And the first part of the book of Daniel, the 11th chapter, basically it deals with 3 major groups of people. It first deals with the Persians, and those are the ones that Daniel was serving under. He was under Darius the Mede, who was a Mede, but the Medes were subservient to the Persian Empire. Excuse me. And then he's going to deal with the Greek. Alexander the Great comes in, and some of the things that are accomplished through Alexander the Great and his successors. And then we're going to see that the Judah, and particularly Jerusalem, under Alexander's followers, his successor, really not Alexander himself, but his successors, is exposed to turmoil the entire time because they are still in sin. They have not reformed themselves. And so Daniel's going to get to see in the future that all this turmoil is going to continue on for many years in the future. And then finally, we're going to get in the 11th chapter, we're going to get exposed to the Roman Empire and the end up with the destruction that the Roman Empire is going to bring upon Jerusalem because of the continued sin of the people. So what God is explaining to Daniel is the people are not going to repent. They're going to get worse and worse, and God is going to finally destroy the Jewish nation. Now, the great hope in the book of Daniel, there's going to be a remnant. There are going to be a people who are going to come out and survive that, and those are going to be the glorious people. And so that's kind of what I see in the rest of chapter 11 and chapter 12. So I'm going to try to pick out a few events of this chapter just to let you see how accurate are some of the things that Daniel is told here by this one. If you want to study this in detail, there are 2 books And has pretty good detail on this. It relates takes history and relates it to the book of Daniel. Young has a commentary on the book of Daniel that he does a pretty good job of taking this chapter and relating it to events of history that would match. And there's a book called Between the Testaments, which is analyzes the history of the period between the Testaments, and it takes and makes some comparisons with Daniel and these the events of history. And so if you want to delve into that in more detail and try to explain many things that I cannot, those will be sources. There are many things in this that are the detail that nobody can explain to your satisfaction or my satisfaction. Just understand that there are some many things in this. As far as the Persian Empire is dealt with, verse 2 of this, he talks about, I'll just read that. Now, I tell you the truth, behold, three more kings are going to arise in Persia. Then a fourth will gain more riches than all of them. And as soon as he becomes strong with his riches, he will rouse the whole empire against the realm of Greece. This, I think, is significant for us. Because if you remember on a map, and I don't have a map up here, but the Greeks are way over close to Italy in the Mediterranean Sea. The Persians are way over close to India, far to the east. I'm doing it backwards for y'all. The Persians would be way over toward India, and the Greeks would be way over in the Mediterranean Sea. The Persian Empire continually kept pushing to the west until they came up and they conquered much of the Asia Minor. We know as Asia Minor now, and it came right up to the Greek cities and the Greek city-states in Asia Minor. Well, that stirred up Alexander the Great's father, Philip of Macedonia, and he, for the first time, got all the Greek states together to oppose the Greek states were all independent. But he got them all to work together to oppose the Persians and to stop their rule. And when he died, his son, Alexander the Great, came to power. In a matter of 10 years, he had pushed all the way through Persia and was up against India with his conquering. And that's kind of what I think is the idea that's going on here in chapter verse 2 there. He will rouse a whole empire against the realm of Greece. Ahasuerus or the Xerxes of the Book of Esther is thought to be this king of Persia, that he became enamored with himself and his power, and he kept pushing toward the west to conquer Macedonia and the Greek Empire. So he aroused them. He stirred them up and only created a problem for himself as he aroused the Greeks. And they were better fighters, better organized. And many battles, the Greeks were outnumbered 4-1, but they conquered the Persians and drove the Persians back. And so I think that's it in this verse 2. The next phase of the history that he's going to deal with in verse 3, a mighty king will arise and he will rule with great authority and do as he pleases. It's easy to identify that with Alexander the Great. He's the one who began his march there in Macedonia and ended up all the way to India. He conquered everything in his path and he set up the Greek culture and Greek cities everywhere he went. And he had an influence well beyond his years because of this conquering setting of the Greek culture. But he died early, and as in this verse 4, but as soon as he has arisen, his kingdom will be broken up and parceled out through the four points of the compass, though not to his own descendants or according to his authority, which he wielded, for his sovereignty will be uprooted and given to others beside him. When he died, five of his generals got power. One of them lost his power. And we have four of his generals ended up in power. There was the Egyptians were under the general Ptolemy, and the Syria and the lands to the east were under the Seleucid generals. The other two generals, not their names escape me right now, they, Seleucus ruled Syria, Cassandra ruled Macedonia, and Lysimachus was the other one. Those are, if you need names for children, please get them out of the book of Daniel. Those of you having children, you just will not have a duplicate in the school if you have a Lysimachus. Anyway, those are not significant because in the book of Daniel, because they don't interact with the children of Israel much. We're going to see that since we have the Ptolemies get control of Egypt and the Seleucids get control of the what was Persia, the Persia and Syria, then Israel or Jerusalem is right in the middle between those two. And so whenever, even though they were generals from the same empire, they always were trying to extend their piece of the pie over top of the other fellow's piece of territory. So there was always a conflict. The Seleucids were always pushing into the Ptolemies' territory, and the Ptolemies were always pushing up into the Seleucids' territory. And so that left Jerusalem in the middle in this conflict. And so what they would find at some point in time, they would be subservient to the Seleucids, and sometimes they'd be subservient to the Ptolemies. They found themselves in the same position they found themselves in before they went to captivity the first time. They were trapped between Egypt and Assyria and Babylon in those days. Now they're trapped between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, two different territories. I'm not going to go into some of the detail here. I do think there's some most interesting stories. If you read this history about where a Ptolemy king would send his daughter up to marry a Seleucid king, and hope that that would bring peace, but they would end up falling out and the whole thing would fall apart. That's foretold here in the book of Daniel, how through intrigue and how through deception. I wish I could remember the verse right now. He talks about two kings sitting down at the same table and making a proposal of peace, but it will not work because they're lying to each other. I thought that sounds like leaders of countries today going to have a peace talk. They're never going to have a truthful conversation with each other. And so the peace is never going to. But that same type of thing is mentioned here in the 11th chapter of Daniel, that these generals or these kings were going to do. And we can turn to history and see that they did these very things. And so that is a type of thing that we see going on. And that goes down through about verse 30 or so, from as I understand it here in the in this reading. Around verses 29 through 36, we have here we have the Romans introduced for the first time, I think, here in verse 30. The Seleucid king had come down to Egypt to try and dominate Egypt. And it says here in verse 29, at the appointed time, he will return and come into the south. The south is Egypt. But this last time it will not turn out the way it did before, for the ships of Kittim will come against him. Therefore, he will be disheartened and return and become enraged at the Holy Covenant and take action. So he will come back and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. The Seleucid king came down to Egypt. The Romans now were beginning to, this is probably about 190 to 200 BC. So it's 250 years after Daniel. The Romans were beginning to exert their power. They wanted to dominate Egypt, so they forced the Seleucid king back to the north. And I just want to read some of the results of that, so to see how this was affecting the children of Israel. And so, it says, for the ships of Kittim will come against him, therefore he will be disheartened and will return and become enraged at the holy covenant and will take action, so that he will come back and will show regard for those who forsake the holy covenant. Forces from him will arise, desecrate the sanctuary fortress, and do away with the regular sacrifice, and they will set up the abomination of desolation. By smooth words, he will turn to godlessness those who act wickedly toward the covenant, but the people who know their God will display strength and take action. Those who have insight among the people will give understanding to the many, yet they will fall by the sword and by flame and by captivity and plunder for many days. Now, when they fall, they will be granted a little help, and many will join in with them in hypocrisy. And some of those who have insight will fall in order to refine, purge, and make them pure until the end time, because it is still to come at the appointed time. Now, there's several things I just want to take note of in this section here. So the Seleucid king comes back up, and this is Antiochus, comes back up, and he is furious because he's been driven out of Egypt. And so he comes back up to the Jerusalem, and talks about he desecrates the sanctuary of the fortress, does away with regular sacrifice, and sets up the abomination of desolation. We've read that term before in the book of Daniel, right? The idea of the idea of abomination is something that would be putrid before God. Would be, and so desolation was linked to the idea that God's temple is completely destroyed. There's nothing going on there. That's what we had with the destruction of Jerusalem to start with. And that's what Daniel kept praying about, because of the desolation was in Jerusalem. Here, Daniel is told that they're going to go back to Jerusalem in this vision. They're going to have some of the people, the temple is going to be desecrated again. The abomination or something putrid is going to go on in that temple. And I think verse 32 is really key to that. By smooth words, he will turn to godlessness those who act wickedly through the covenant. But the people who know their God will display strength and take action. Those who act through the covenant are children of Israel. The Jews have gone back. And so we have the Jews acting in two groups now. And I think it's significant for us to see here. But this Seleucid leader, with smooth words and deception, he will turn to godlessness those who are of the covenant. What occurred, some of the Jews became so enamored with the philosophy and the culture of the Greeks that they became endorsers of the Greek culture. And so when these conflicts would come, they would join forces with the Greeks and try to get the people to convert to the Greek lifestyle rather than to live the holy lifestyle of God. And so what we have in this verse, then we have some but the people who know their God will display strength and take action. Some of the people who are devoted to the covenant, that's people like Daniel in his day. And people, if we read through all the judges and the books of the kings, when a person got stirred up by his faith in God and saw the corruption going on around, they rose up and they took action. They're going to be people who rise up and take action. This probably has reference to the period of the Maccabees and the revolts that the Maccabees brought against the Greeks and against the Jews that were being partners with the Greeks in trying to take control. By this time, the high priesthood had become a political football. The Greeks would appoint the person to be high priest who could raise the most tax money for them. And so it became a political football. And in order for you as a high priest to be in a position, you would have had to adopt an alliance with Greek philosophy, with Greek living, and adopted that was an acceptable so you can make some money out of it. This seems to be the rise of the Sadducees that we see in the New Testament. You see, the Sadducees don't have a deep faith in the scriptures. They don't have a deep faith in the resurrection, right? They don't have a deep faith in many things. They begin to more think like the Greek philosophers. So this is probably what gave rise to the Sadducees, is those were the, and that's why the priesthood, when we get the New Testament, it seems to be in the hands of the Sadducees because they're playing politics, first with the Greeks and next with the Romans. And this is also probably what gave rise to the Pharisees. He's talking about those who have knowledge, who have understanding, they and who have insight, they will oppose that. Well, the Maccabean revolt starts with a group of priests who are not aligned with the Sadducees priest, and they're for strict teaching the law. When we get to the New Testament, who was strict about the law? The Pharisees were. So this seems to be their origin of these two groups is in this association with the Greeks. And so they will rise and take action. And you can read the book of the several books of the Maccabees. You can read those and see the wars that went on and some of these alliances that were made with the Greek rulers. And we see it's very parallel to what is being recorded for us here. Daniel's recording it 250 years. Before it happens, and now he's, we can see the Maccabean writers, the history of the Maccabees records this. And so these people have insight, and we see it's not going to be, to me it's interesting to deal with two or three things here in verse 33. Those who have insight among will give understanding to the many. They're going to try and teach the many. The Pharisees became the teachers of the law. Yet they will fall by the sword and by flame, by captivity and by plunder for many days. It's not going to be good for them when they stand up for the word. And when they fall, they will be granted a little help and many will join them in hypocrisy. Well, when it looks like the cause is down, they're going to rise up. They're going to have some help. They're going to expel the Greeks for a period of time. But there are going to be some people hypocritically take a part in that, and they will be, and some of those who have insight will fall in order to refine, purge, and make them pure until the end time, because it is still to come at the appointed time. I think that's a very important verse for us there. We've got all of this. We've got this corruption of the priesthood. We've got some people that are trying to be holy. We've got the Greeks trying to take over here. And so we've got something that it looks like it's going there. Many of them are getting killed. Looks like it's going to collapse. But what does he tell us? It's going to survive to the end time. Now, again, I think in the context, it's this end that Daniel sees everything going toward. That's to the destruction of the Jerusalem. So we're going to have a group survive who are a faithful remnant that will be here when the Christ comes. They will not be destroyed. And I think that's, and this is going on to purge and make them pure until the end time. So there will be some pure people that are purged out of this. There will be some pure people left will be here when Christ comes as we're approaching the destruction, the final destruction of Jerusalem. Well, some thoughts here, but I do think that's kind of what we got going on here. Eddie?
I think you're right. I think this 29 through 35 is a very significant part of this chapter, because the wars that were described before, God's people were still allowed to worship at the temple. They were allowed to offer the sacrifices. But this event changed it. Okay. This event, the temple was not burned down to ground, but it was desecrated, and the sacrifices were ended. And so this was a very significant event that Daniel was seeing that would come in the future. But this happened, how that a few, a remnant, would stand up for what is right, and even those that stood up for what is right, we're going to face opposition, not only from the Greeks, but also from their own people.
Right. Okay.
But like you're right, at the very end, he says, if they will be able to continue the temple.
Okay. And so this is really significant, I think, to Daniel, because Daniel has had that back in chapter 9. He had that it ended with 70 times 7, and that term, again, the abomination will come, one who makes desolate. Now, is that one in Daniel 9 is not this one. It's going to be the one that is in Matthew 24. It talks about when the Romans destroy the temple. That's going to be the abomination that makes desolate there. And so now we've got a halfway there, I'm going to say in rough terms, from them going back to Jerusalem. Halfway there, we've got this same cycle again. They have become, as he says here, and it's for them to purge and to make them pure. They have become very corrupt and evil in God's sight. And so now this happens again. Daniel's being told, yes, they're going back, but it's going to be tough because people are not going to follow God, and they're going to be purged in that. So I think that's to me, that's really one of the significant sections in this 11th chapter. Any other thoughts here? Okay, pick up in verse 36. I believe that he now begins to talk about the influence of the Roman Empire in verse 36. In this, and I just want to look at a few things that he talks about the Roman Empire. I think that we can identify these with the Roman Empire. Then the king will do as he pleases, and he will exalt and magnify himself above every god, and will speak monstrous things against the God of gods. And he will prosper until the indignation is finished, for that which is decreed will be done. There again, that which is decreed will be done. God is saying what's going to happen. He will show no regard for the gods of his fathers or for the desire of women, nor will he show regard for any other god, for he will magnify himself above them all. But instead, he will honor a god of fortresses, a god whom his fathers did not know. He will honor him with gold, silver, costly stones, and treasures. He will take action against the strongest of forces, and with help of a foreign god, he will give great honor to those who acknowledge him and will cause them to rule over the many, and will parcel out land for a price. This seems to be a picture of the way the Roman Empire under the Caesars began to operate. We know that when the Caesars came to power, they allowed themselves to be identified with the gods. And they took on the concept of Caesar was God. And that's why we see many times we see in the New Testament where there's conflict because the Christians won't worship the Caesar. Won't pay homage to them as God. Well, the Caesars were apparently they. I know that some of the Persian and the other rulers, they had a big ego, but it does not seem like they identified themselves as God, like the Caesars did. They accepted worship as God, and so that seems to be the idea. He have in verse 13. He will show no regard for the gods, his father, or the desire of women. or show regard for any other God, for he will magnify himself above them all. Some things I think that suggest that, you know, he won't, the gods that they'd worshiped idols before, he won't, he'll see himself as equal above them, is the idea. It talks about he will do as he pleases and magnify himself. The Roman Empire was so forceful and so strong that whenever they came, they trampled, they destroyed, they controlled, and they took over. They ruled with an iron fist whenever they came in. But instead, he will honor a God of fortresses, a God whom his fathers did not know. He will honor him with gold, silver, and stones. I think that's the idea of building fortresses, being a strong controller of people. He will be, the Romans will operate that way. In verse 39, he will take action against the strongest of fortresses and will help with the help of a foreign God. He will give honor to those who acknowledge him and cause him to rule over the many. Will parcel out land for a price. The strongest of fortresses, Rome would build siege walls, they would tear down the cities, and there was nothing that would stop the Roman army. We were a few years ago, we were able to take a trip, and we went to Jerash, which is in Jordan. And there they have a group of people who reenact the military maneuvers of the Roman army. And it was very interesting to see some of their maneuvers and how if you were fighting a hand-to-hand combat, in which much of the combat was in that day, with their shields and their spears and their helmets and everything, how they were, the Roman army would have been almost invincible as they formed their different maneuvers. They would they showed us how they could bring them all together and form a wedge movement and various things, and how against other people, the Roman army was just almost unconquerable because of their military strategy and tactics. Well, that seems to be the idea here. This is going to be a group that has an army that's unstoppable like that. And he'll act against the strongest of forces. And it talks about he will parcel out land for a price. We do know that the Romans appointed subservient kings based upon them collecting taxes and sending the taxes to Rome. Herod was a king because he was in alliance with the Caesars and he taxed the people. And so they had subservient kings. He parceled out the land to Rome, and they served at the benefit of the Caesars. Okay, it says, and at the end time, the king of the south will collide with him, and the king of the north will storm against him with chariots and horsemen and many ships, and he will enter countries, overflow them, and pass through. And then, the part I want to get to here, and he will also enter the beautiful land, and many countries will fall, but those who will be rescued out of his hand, Edom, Moab, and the foremost of the sons of Ammon. It will stretch out his hand against the other countries. The land of Egypt will not escape, but he will gain control over the hidden treasures, the gold and the silver and the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians will fall at his heels. And so that's why I think this is a picture of the Roman Empire. The Persians never conquered Egypt. They never conquered Greece. The Ptolemies never... They went down and fought with Egypt, but they never maintained control on the Ptolemies. But the Seleucids, they never maintained control of Egypt. The first group to maintain this dominance of Egypt was the Romans. And they conquered Egypt and Ethiopia. I do not have a clue as why they were not able to conquer the sons of Edom, Moab, or Ammon. But it says they do not conquer them. I want to make note here. This king or this empire entered the beautiful land. What do you think the beautiful land is to Daniel? That's the land of Israel. They entered and controlled that. So we see the Romans did come in and control the land of Egypt, or land of Israel. In verse 45, he will pitch the tents of his royal pavilion between the sea and a beautiful holy mountain. that he will come to his end and no one will help him. I think that's an interesting comment there. If you know the Roman port city in Israel was Caesarea Maritime. That's where Paul often would board his ship and go out on a missionary journey. That's between the sea and the Holy Mountains. That's interesting if that's what he may be talking about there. That was the judgment seat of the Roman government in Judea, was there Caesarea Maritime. And so that was where Herod had his judgment seat and the other Roman group. But when Paul went there before he was shipped off, was in this. And so I do think it's interesting that perhaps is what he's talking about there. So we have this transition in chapter 11 from the Persians to the Greeks to the Romans. The Jews do not fare well in any of this. I think it's related to their sin. They're not being faithful, but there is a remnant, and we're still working toward an appointed time. A time of the end is what we're working toward. Now, chapter 12 is the time of the end. This is a chapter I think is very much in parallel with Matthew 24. And so what I don't cover tonight, Dempsey can pick up in Matthew 24 with that. It says, now at that time, that's at the time that the Roman Empire is camped between the sea and the Holy Mountain. They're maintaining governance from Caesarea Maritime. At that time, Michael, the great prince who stands guard over the sons of your people, will arise. There will be a time of distress such as never occurred since there was a nation until the time that at the time your people, everyone who is found written in the book of life, will be rescued. Does that sound like Romans or Matthew 24? Let's go back. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation in verse 15, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. Then there those will be who are in Judah must flee to the mountains, and whoever is in on the housetop must not go down and get the things that are in the housetop. And so in verse 24, then there will be a great tribulation such as not occurred since the beginning of the world until now or ever will. Unless those days had been shortened or cut short, no life would have been saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. So Daniel is being told here that there's going to come a time when there's going to be a tribulation that's going to occur that is unlike any that's occurred before. The same thing that Jesus says in Matthew 24. In verse 2, he says, many of those asleep in the dust of the ground will awake, these to everlasting life, but the others to disgrace and everlasting contempt. Those who have insight will shine brightly like the brightness of the expanse of heaven, and those who lead the many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. So he says there's going to come a time of great distress, the same thing that Jesus talks about. And he talks about really three groups of people. Two of them are very closely related. He talks about those who have insight will shine. Well, I'm going to go back for it. Those who are asleep in the dust of the ground will awake, these to everlasting life, but the others to disgrace and everlasting contempt. We've got two people that are said to be asleep in the ground and they're going to awake. And that many times it makes us want to jump to the very end of time and the final resurrection. But I think what Daniel is being told here by this Holy One has come to him, there's going to be a resurrection of God's cause. His purpose is going to be resurrected at that point. And there's some people that are going to resurrected are going to see that they are glorious, and others are going to show how contemptible they were. And if you think back to the people who were living in the day, when we talked about the earlier, when the Greeks were trying to get the Greek influence to take over, we had a group of people who, of the Sadducean outlook, who were opposing the goals of the strict law outlook. And so many of the righteous outlook died, and many of the unrighteous outlook, the ungodly outlook, they survived and got control. What's going to happen here is we're going to see that it's flipped. The ones that are going to be honored or given honor are the ones who remain faithful to God. And I think that's the point here. This is much like it's a resurrection of a spirit or resurrection of a purpose or a cause. The cause of God is going to be resurrected. And I liken this very much to Ezekiel 37, one of my favorite pictures of the Old Testament, I think most of us, is this valley of dry bones. And we come out and Ezekiel sees, and he thinks the nation of Israel is done. And he sees this valley of dry bones, and he's asked the question by the one speaking to him, can these bones live? And all of a sudden we hear the rattling and the sinews, and that's all a symbol of Israel coming back to life after captivity. And I think that's what we have here is this picture. That which appears to be in the dust to be destroyed is going to come to life. And that which opposed it is going to be exposed as contemptible. And then in verse 3, and those who have insight will shine brightly like the brightness of the expanse of heaven, and those who lead the many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. That's one, I think verse 3 is a clue that it's not the very end of time. Because we've got the idea of some leading others to righteousness. That will not be at the end of time. That's when the judgment comes. Yes, Eddie?
In John 5, Jesus speaks about two resurrections. He says the first one is a resurrection from death to life. And he says it now is.
Okay.
As he was proclaiming that message of salvation, he was bringing the dead, the God's covenant people, back to life.
Okay.
And I think that's what
he's being shown that, you know, there's going to become this marvelous resurrection of God's purpose. Now, the disappointing thing for Daniel is he's already been told there's going to be this destruction that's unimaginable on your people. And now Daniel is not given, I think it's interesting that in his other vision, he sees the Messiah is cut off and he's never given the rest of the story. Daniel is not. He's only given a glimpse of the rest of the story here that there will be a resurrection of God's purpose, and there will be those who are prospering teaching that resurrection. I think that's pointing to the apostles and the prophets in the New Testament, that they would be prospering in teaching that. And so, but as few Daniel conceal these words and seal up the book until the end of time, many will go back and forth and knowledge will increase. So it's talk about the end of time. I think the end time. Seal these things. You know, Daniel wrote them down. We have a copy of them. And people before Daniel's day after Daniel's day had a copy of them. So it's not sealed up in the sense they were not available, were not visible. They're sealed up in the sense they're not going to be understandable until the time of the future, and then they will be revealed the meaning of it. You can stand and look back at it, and that's I think that's the idea. Daniel, you're not going to get that explanation, and so you write these down, and you're not going to get that explanation. And then it says, and then I, Daniel, looked, and behold, two others were standing, one on this bank of the river and the other on that bank of the river. And the one said to the man dressed in linen, who was above the waters of the river, how long will it be until the end of these wonders? I heard the man dressed in linen who was above the waters of the river, as he raised his right hand and his left toward the heaven and swore by him who lives forever that it would be for a time, times, and a half a time. As soon as they finish scattering the power of the holy people, all these events will be completed. Or shattering the power of the holy people, all these events will be completed. So Daniel's wondering about when it's going to take place. He's given this comment about a time, times and a half a time. It's one of those figurative things that he's put in the scriptures. We see it repeated in the book of Revelation. We see it in the Old Testament in two or three other places. It seems to be a period of conflict that he's talking about in this, because going back to the days of Elijah and his conflict with Ahab and Jezebel, it seemed to have been a 3.5-year drought there, a time of conflict. It seems to be a period of conflict. So there's going to be a period of conflict to go through. The conflict is never present, but at the end of this conflict, these events will be completed. So Jerusalem is going to, the apostles are going to be, we're going to have this persecution of Christians, I think is the idea. There's going to be a period of conflict. At the end of that, these things that we've talked about will be completed. As for me, I heard but could not understand. So I said, oh, Lord, what will be the outcome of these events? He said, go your way, Daniel. For these words are concealed and sealed up until the end time. Again, to the end of the nation. Many will be purged, purified, and refined, but the wicked will act wickedly. None of the wicked will understand, but those who have insight will understand. For the time that the regular sacrifice is abolished, the abomination of desolation is set up, there will be 1,290 days. How blessed is he who keeps waiting, attains to 1,335 days. But as for you, go your way to the end. Then you will enter into the rest and rise again for your allotted portion at the end of the age. So, two or three things in this I just want to note here is Daniel's not given the answer, the explanation that he was hoping for on some of these things. That's sealed up. Verse 10, there are going to be many purged, purified, and refined, but the wicked will act wickedly, and none of the wicked will understand. That's a picture of the Pharisees and the Sadducees when Jesus came. They acted wickedly, but they never understood the gospel that Jesus was presenting to them. And I think that's the idea that's going to be that. And then he talks about this time from the regular sacrifices abolished, abomination of desolation. That seems to have to do with how long is it? It has to do with the time from the Romans taking the temple and destroying the temple. It symbolically represents that time of distress in some way. The blessed is he who survives unto the 1,335 days. You get through that, seems to be the idea. And that's what I think in Matthew 24, he told him to escape from the mountain to the mountain to escape that. I think that's some of the things that might be suggested there. But Daniel, you go your way. You're going to be blessed. And if we've got the end of time anywhere, it's in the very last there. You will get your reward. Okay. I ran through that, but that's kind of what I see here in the 11th and 12th chapters. It's a very direct look, but by the Holy One to Daniel about the time and what leads up to the coming of Christ and the destruction of the wicked nation of Israel. Okay. Thoughts, comments?
Dan,
yeah.
This part of verse 10 where it says, many will be purified, cleansed, and refined, but the wicked won't understand.
Right.
You have to consider, how are the righteous going to be purified, cleansed, and refined? They're going to have to go through the fire.
Right.
That's how the purification takes place. And that's consistent with the message of the end of the Old Testament. You know, the latter minor prophets all talk about this purification process and the fact that it's going to come through hard times. And so when the wicked look at that and they see the righteous being persecuted, they're not going to understand. They're going to say they're getting what they deserve because, you know, they're acting foolishly, believing in a God that's going to save them, and they're getting what, you know, they're just deserts. Mm-hmm. The righteous will understand, though, that hard times are what will purify us.
Yeah.
That's the wisdom that comes from it. And so when he tells Daniel, you know, you're not going to understand all that. You're not going to know everything that's going to happen. But your part is to endure to the end. And that's consistent with the message throughout the rest of Scripture. You get the book of Malachi, where the wicked are saying, who can, why is it worth anything to follow the Lord? You know, the wicked are prospering. Why is it any good to follow the Lord? But the righteous remember the Lord, and they were the ones who were remembered by the Lord, and their names were written in the book of life. So then Jesus comes onto the scene 400 years later, and he says, times are coming. Hard times are coming. But the one who endures to the end, and he says it multiple times, the one who endures to the end will be saved. And so then you get to look like Revelation. I mean, just look at the letters to the seven churches. Each of the letters ends with a statement about the victor and what will come to the victor who endures to the end. And so it's just this consistent red thread of the entire scriptures. And that's it's all right here in David.
Okay.
And it's consistent with the theme, sorry, that you gave us from the very beginning. God is the king. You know, no matter what all these other kingdoms do, no matter what persecutions may arise, what happens in history, God is the king. And his kingdom is going to last.
Okay. And that's hard for us to fathom sometimes, living on this earth. But I appreciate that, Adam. That really is a good place for us to end in the book of Daniel, that God is in charge. It's going to, you know, the righteous are going to suffer. How many times in the Old Testament did they suffer? My greatest example is Jeremiah. Jeremiah the prophet suffered, you know, regularly. And Daniel suffered, and the other individuals suffered. But stay with God, and in the end, he will reward you. Thank you. I've enjoyed the book of Daniel. I just want to say that I'm sorry I got interrupted so many times of being gone a couple of times on this. I appreciate Kevin taking the class during that time. Every time I read through any book, it's my favorite book when I'm reading it. So Daniel's been my favorite book the last couple of months. But there is so much to be gained by every time you study it. And we need to always look at it from the perspective that this is a part of God's whole story that he's delivering. It's not a isolated thing about four guys in captivity. It's God's delivering us a message about who he is and who we are. All right. Thank you. I guess we won't meet next Sunday night, but the following Sunday night, we will have our prayer meeting. John's got that ready. He's already sent out some outlines on that. This would be the following Sunday night. All right. Thank you. Come back Wednesday night. Okay. Let's have a prayer at this time. Our dear holy God and Father, we come before you. We are feeble in our understanding. We pray that you will help us to go back and reread your word and open with an open mind, with a desire to know what you have told for us. We especially want to ask you to help us to have our complete faith and trust in you, knowing that no matter what happens, you are God and you are our King, and you will reward us in the end. In Christ's name we pray, amen.